I said. She's awesome. He moved over to the next table. Don't feel bad. It was just a super stroke of luck. She showed up when she did that night. I'm still in this, I reminded him. All I have to do is date a bunch of people once, and I'm doing that. True, true, he agreed. Out on the street, someone zoomed past, tires squealing. I could only hope it wasn't one of the valets. So you're saying you have another prospect already lined up? I'm working on it, I said, which wasn't exactly a lie if thinking counted as working. What I'd actually been mulling, a bit worriedly, was that if Jilly was so into Michael Salem, I'd be losing the one person who was happy to set me up repeatedly, unless he had a friend, or, lots of friends. Well, good, Ambrose said. It's no fun if we can't keep it interesting. Don't worry about that. You just focus on you, I said, walking over to another table and bending over the row of small votives there to blow them out. Once done, I looked up to see him staring at me. What? You really don't make a wish? Like, ever? It's not my birthday, and this isn't a cake, I pointed out. Yeah, but it doesn't have to be. Why wouldn't you ask for something, given the chance? Birthdays are special. These are just candles. Still counts, he said firmly. Ambrose, come on. What? You don't need anything? Your life is perfect? It's just a wish, I said. I don't want to burst your bubble, but just because you make them doesn't increase the chances of them working. You're still putting it out there, though, he countered. Into the universe. Has to count. I looked down at the row of four flames in front of me, still lit. Let's just agree to disagree, okay? It's your thing, like stealing dogs and doing the conga. Doesn't mean it has to be mine, right? That's how you sum me up? He asked, and I smiled. Dog stealer and conga dancer? And wishmaker, I added. I'm just not. That's okay, right? He held my gaze for a second, and I had the fleeting thought, out of nowhere, that he might say it wasn't. Instead, though, he came over and bent down, then closed his eyes, blowing out the row from one end to another. When he was done, he gave me a smile, then walked off to the next table. It wasn't until later, driving home, that I realized he'd never answered my question, but I knew the real reply to his. My last birthday, I'd closed my eyes and thought of nothing when I leaned over my cake. You stop believing in wishes when the only one you want to make can never come true. Chapter 18. That morning, I texted Ethan as soon as I woke up, like I did every day. I never got out of bed until I saw his return message pop up on my screen. Morning, Lulu. Have a good one. With that, I pushed back the covers, getting to my feet, and went to take a shower, dropping my phone onto the speaker just outside the bathroom on my way. I didn't listen to Lexi Navigator that particular day, even though it was my go-to rise and shine music. Instead, it was news, just headlines, none of which I remembered after toweling myself off. Once dressed, I grabbed my backpack and headed downstairs, where my mother was still in her bathrobe watching Daybreak USA, her favorite morning show. For the 2 hours it was on each day, she'd keep up a running commentary on the four hosts, weighing in on their hair and makeup, their reactions as they interviewed guests, and their interplay with each other. Everyone had something, I guess, and my mom's was a morning news program. Melissa is just too thin these days, she said to me as I popped a bagel in the toaster, checking the clock. I know she's going through that divorce, but she needs to take care of herself. I glanced at the screen, where Melissa Scott, in a teal dress, was reporting on the stock market. She looked fine to me. What do you and William have going on today? Just prep for Rachel Quaker's rehearsal dinner and the wedding tomorrow, she replied. During the school year, I only worked on weekends, so I was less up to date on the various events we had planned. This one, though, I remembered, if only for the unique last name. "This is the one with the bucking bronco, right?" I asked. She sighed, closing her eyes. On the TV, Drew Tate, the meteorologist, was now pointing at a weather map. "It's a mechanical bull, and I can't believe you're bringing it up when it's not absolutely necessary." "Sorry," I said, stifling a laugh. It wasn't easy to throw something at my mom she wasn't experienced with, but Rachel Quaker, a native Texan, had done just that when she requested a rodeo-themed rehearsal dinner. Besides the bull, there would be special-ordered barbecue and ribs trucked in from her home state, complimentary cowboy hats for all guests, and beribboned baskets full of wet naps. My mother had been complaining about it for weeks. The only upside was that the wedding itself was as traditional as the dinner was not. Big church, big guest list, really big money. If my mom had a price for dealing with electronic animals, they'd clearly met it. "Mark my words, someone will break their neck. We can only pray it is not the bride or groom," she replied, which had been her mantra since the planning had gotten underway months earlier. She took a sip of her coffee, nodding at the TV. "Look at Patrick Williams. He's had so much Botox, he can't even look concerned for those poor people on that wrecked ferry." My bagel popped up and I grabbed it, taking another look at the screen. This time, I could see her point. Patrick Williams had never met a cosmetic procedure he didn't like, and HD kept no secrets. "I gotta go. I told Jilly I'd meet her early to study for that Spanish quiz." "Be sure to eat that whole bagel," she called after me as I started for the door. "I've got enough worries with Melissa." In the car, I ate half as I headed out of our neighborhood, then turned onto the main road to school. At the first stoplight, my phone beeped. It was Jilly, driving Kit Kat and Crawford to school like she did every day. "Lunchbox fail. Be there ASAP. Courtyard?" I glanced at the light, still red, then quickly replied with a thumbs up. As traffic started moving again, I heard my ringtone.
"Hola, niña bonita," Ethan said when I picked up. "¿Estás lista para la prueba?"
I think the fact that I have no idea what you are saying does not bode well for this quiz today, I replied.
"I asked if you were ready for the test," he said, laughing. "Also, I called you a pretty girl."
"Well, that's nice," I smiled. "And the answer is clearly no." I heard someone's voice in the background. He drove to his own school every day with three of his buddies, and the collective volume was always high.
"Will you guys shut up? I'm trying to talk to my girlfriend."
I felt my face flush. That never got old.
"You're always talking to your girlfriend," someone said. "And aren't we stopping for donuts? It's Friday." "No can do. I said I'd meet Coach in his office before the late bell," Ethan said.
To me, he added, "Still not sure what this is about. Got me kind of in knots." "It's got to be good," I told him, as I had the night before and the day before that. Getting called in for a special meeting with his lacrosse coach could only mean something really good or bad, according to Ethan. My money was on the former, but I understood his worry. "Be sure to text me, though. I'm curious."
"You and me both."
Another chorus of laughter from the background.
"I'd better go. We're almost there. Talk at lunch?"
"Yep," I said as school came up in the distance. Usually I got to mine first, as he and his buddies were always stopping for food en route. "I can tell you how badly I bombed that quiz."
"Vas a hacer bien," he replied.
"I don't know what that means."
"You'll do fine," he told me, laughing. "Love you, Lulu."
"Love you too," I told him. "Talk soon." I pulled into the lot, then wound around looking for a parking space. By the time I found one, in the lower part dotted with dusty potholes, my console clock said 7:55. I had 20 minutes to find Jilly, cram like crazy, and then hope for the best for the quiz. When I got to the bench in the courtyard where we always met, she wasn't there, so I sat down and pulled out my book to go over verb tenses. I thought about Ethan going to his coach's office at probably right that same moment, and closed my eyes, thinking a good thought for him. By the time the bell rang, Jilly still hadn't shown up. So much for studying, I thought, although I wasn't exactly surprised. Everything at the Baker house was nuts, but the mornings were especially so, which was why Jilly had such a low grade in Spanish. She was always late. I was just bad at it, apparently. When I got to class, Señor Richards was already giving out the quizzes. I slid into a seat and opened my bag, taking out a pen and checking the door again for Jilly as he handed me mine. I scanned the first question. No idea. Great. The late bell rang, and after the normal amount of backpack zipping and general settling in noises, the room fell silent around me. As I worked down the page, I realized I wasn't entirely clueless, which was encouraging. Up at the front of the room, Señor Richards was on his laptop, brow furrowed as he scanned the screen. By the time I'd finished the quiz as best I could, it was 8:45 and I was one of the last ones to hand in my paper. As I did, I glanced outside for Jilly. A half hour was late, even for her. A few moments later, Señor Richards got to his feet, coming around to lean against the desk, and told us in Spanish to open our books to page 176. The subjunctive, the title heading said in English. The upshot seemed to be that you used it when you weren't certain. Well, I thought, that would come in handy for me. Just then, outside the half-open door, I heard someone running down the hallway. For a minute, I thought it was Jilly, but then they passed by, a blur in my side vision as Señor Richards directed our attention to the board, where he was busy writing something in his boxy print. At 9:05, when the bell rang, signaling the end of the period, I immediately pulled out my phone, expecting to see a string of increasingly panicked texts from her over the last 50 minutes. But there was nothing except a bunch of news alerts, which I didn't bother to read. I had a long way to go in the 5 minutes we were given between classes if I wasn't going to be late myself to art history. As usual, everyone seemed to be moving super slowly when I was in a rush. The hallway was packed with people on their phones or talking loudly to each other as I wound through bodies and backpacks, trying to get to the one staircase that was usually less crowded than the others. By the time I got downstairs, I only had 2.5 minutes until the bell. I did notice a lot of people standing around the TV in the main office, looking at something, but it didn't occur to me to see what it was. Once outside, I passed a couple making out and two guys walking super slowly with instrument cases as I headed for the steps that led to the art and theater building. I pulled my backpack closer and started up them, taking the last couple two at a time, then popped out right by my classroom's back door, which Miss DiMarcello, bless her, kept propped open because she knew it was a valued shortcut.
Luna!
When I heard Jilly's voice, some aspect of it, tone, volume, a trembling, made me stop where I was. I turned around to see her coming toward me across the grass, where you weren't allowed to walk, her footsteps leaving prints in the dew. She had one hand to her mouth, and her eyes were wide. Without even knowing why, I suddenly felt cold. "Oh, my God," I said, rushing over to meet her. "What happened? Are you okay? Is it one of the kids?" The bell rang then, loud and piercing. She reached out, her fingers clamping my upper left arm. "No, it's not. Luna, there's been a shooting." "A what?" I said. Just behind me, I could hear my teacher rapping her hand on the wooden desk to quiet everyone down, just like she always did. I don't understand. In response, she pulled out her phone. Breaking, it said, in yellow block letters on the screen, above an image of a flat cinder block building with a flagpole out front, a tiger painted on its side. Shooter confirmed at high school, Brownwood, New Jersey. I just looked at the words, trying to make sense of them.
Oh, my God,
I said, immediately pulling out my own phone, fingers shaking as I selected Ethan's number. It went straight to voicemail, but that wasn't unusual. He wasn't allowed to have his phone out in class. Still, I fired off a text. You okay? For when he would see it. Because Ethan was fine. He had to be. What were the chances? I was late with Crawford's stupid lunchbox thing, and I heard them break in on the radio, she said. She was still holding my arm. It was in the gym. At least that's what they were saying. Ethan's first class was English. I knew this as well as, if not better than, the fact that Spanish was my own. He wouldn't have been in the gym, I said. He starts in the main building. Oh, good, she said. She eased her grip, finally letting her hand drop. When I heard Brownwood and they said there were fatalities, I looked back at my screen and the two words I'd sent, willing the dots to appear beneath them that would signal he was typing a response. Nothing. Luna? I heard Miss DiMarcello call from the door behind me. Time to come in. We're starting. One second. I called over my shoulder. I looked at Jilly. He's fine, right? It's a huge school. He always says so. I'm sure he is, she said. And it sounds like he wasn't even near there. Yeah. I swallowed, looking at my phone again. I guess I'll go into class. Okay, she said. Neither of us moved. I'm sure he'll text you any minute. I heard footsteps and looked behind her to see a school resource officer coming toward us. There were two. One was wide and muscular, built like a fire plug. The other skinny and tall. This was the skinny one. Ladies, it's past late bell. Move along to your second periods. I'm going, Jilly told him, then looked at me again. Text me the minute you hear. I will. I said. He was still standing there, watching us. I slipped my phone in my pocket and went inside. For the next 50 minutes, Ms. DiMarcello stood in front of the board, lecturing about the Surrealists. Not that I could have told you then or now what she said. I wrote not one word on the empty white page of the notebook in front of me, my eyes instead on my phone's screen, which I had hidden under my coat in my lap. Our school, like Ethan's and most others, had a strict in-class no-screen policy that I usually followed. But that day, I would have fought someone to keep it close and on. By the time the bell rang, there was still no word. The minute I got back outside, I dialed him again. This time, it went straight to voicemail without even ringing. Clearly, I was not the only one calling. I pulled up my texts. Please let me know you are okay. No dots. I felt suddenly sick and lurched over to a nearby trash can, pulling my hair back. But nothing happened. Just people pushing past, talking on their way to class like any other day. Then a beep. Thank God! I thought, tears springing to my eyes. Any word? Jilly. I typed her back. No. Then started walking down to the main building, still gripping my phone in my hand. My next class was Western Civ, all the way down by the bus parking lot. It wasn't until I was about halfway there that I remembered something about my conversation with Ethan that morning.
Said I'd meet Coach in his office before the late bell.
I stopped walking right where I was, causing someone to bump me from behind. They exhaled, then cut around me as I opened my news app. The latest wasn't hard to find. It was right at the top. Breaking story, shooting at New Jersey High School. I clicked the link, which took me to a picture of that same school building and flagpole, this time with cop cars parked all around the front of it. Three bullet points, designed for scanning quickly, were below. Shots fired just before first period around 8:20 a.m. Multiple victims reportedly in gym area. Shooter believed to be current student acting alone. 8:20, I thought. I'd just gotten my Spanish quiz. Ethan should have been in English, trying not to look at the hair of the girl in front of him, which he maintained was so greasy it literally dripped onto his desk. I knew this. I knew everything about him. So how did I not know if he was all right? The hallway was emptying as everyone went into classrooms and down the nearby staircase. Moments earlier, it had been packed, elbow to elbow, with me just one of a sea of people. Now I stood there, staring at my screen, until all the doors around me shut and I was the only one left, standing alone. I told myself I wasn't moving until I knew something, that I'd stop time in this interim. Later, it would seem silly that I thought I could do this, have some control over events already unfolded. But I believed in a lot of things before. I never heard from Ethan again. Chapter 19. Do you want a tissue? William said to my mother in an attempt at humor. He nodded at Mrs. Lynn's ample bosom, where a Kleenex was indeed poking out at the ready. Because I know where to find one. In response, my mother just blinked, trying to hold back the tears of frustration that were brimming in her eyes. Just moments earlier, she'd found out via text that the next week's wedding, for which we'd done tons of legwork and put down multiple deposits, had been called off. Then, as she was absorbing that news, Mrs. Lynn approached and unloaded a loud, shrieking tirade about her sudden, strong dislike of the tulle bows tied on the backs of the chairs, which had been her idea in the first place. It was the latest in a long day of similar takedowns over tiny details anyone else would have cracked hours earlier. It took my mom until now, almost 8 p.m., and 3 hours past the ceremony, but finally she'd gotten there. As William patted her shoulder, moving his hand in that familiar, soothing circle, I forced myself to take a deep breath. I hated to see my mother upset. Mostly because it never happened, so it was kind of scary, like the world, or my world, was tilting the wrong way on its axis. "Luna, I'm fine," she said to me now, clearly aware of this. "I'm pissed off, not sad. And it's mostly about the Marlowe Wagner cancellation. At least now we know why she bailed on the photo shoot." Being yelled at about the chair bows did not help matters, though. William said, moving his hand now in the other direction. "Considering we were clear we were against it from the start. Who wants their chair gift-wrapped? And then she takes her bad decision out on you? Unacceptable." "I hate this wedding," my mother grumbled, wiping her eyes with a tissue not snatched from someone's chest. "And I hate that woman," William told her. "But let's look at the upside, shall we? No Wagner wedding next weekend means we can actually go on that freebie trip to check out St. Samara for the Care wedding." "Oh, God," my mother groaned. "Are you still even thinking about that? We don't do out-of-town weddings, and now you want to try one on an island?" "Correction. I want to take a free trip to an island under the guise of considering a wedding there." he told her. Just think about it. Beach, clear blue water, cocktails with umbrellas, all expenses paid. If you didn't already deserve it, you definitely do after tonight. As if to punctuate this, Mrs. Lin began at that moment to lay into a member of the catering staff. The woman, startled, cowered back, a tray of empty glasses trembling above her. I looked over to the head table, where Eleanor Lin was huddled close with her new husband, their heads ducked together, both of them smiling. While part of me wished she'd take responsibility for the tornado that was her mother, I had to admit she looked awfully happy, and God knew she probably deserved it. We'd only dealt with Mrs. Lin for a few weeks. I couldn't imagine an entire life. As I thought this, Ambrose walked up to our little confab.
All clear on the fainting junior bridesmaid, he reported. I just checked on her again, and she's fine.
Hearing this, I glanced over at the head table where, sure enough, the tween who'd passed out during the vows earlier was now giggling with one of the flower girls. We were used to people getting woozy, if not blacking out altogether. It was why my mom always gave her, "Don't lock your knees and standing will be a breeze," speech at rehearsals, especially when it was hot outside. Inevitably, though, we had a few people go down, and this girl had done it in spectacular fashion, crashing into a flower arrangement and taking it with her. When she came to and realized what happened, she was so embarrassed she burst into tears. I'd led her into a side room, water in hand, prepared to stay with her there until the ceremony ended, but it was Ambrose who proved to be crucial in the moment.
"You think that was bad?"
he asked her, sliding into the folding chair adjacent to her own.
"I'll tell you about embarrassing. This one time, I was trying to walk backward while talking to a girl and didn't see the curb. Fell over it, landed right on my tailbone, screamed like a baby. It was horrifying."
The junior bridesmaid, face red, just looked at him. "Really?"
"Oh, yeah," he said, waving his hand easily. "And that was nothing. Another time at school, I was giving this presentation on toxic waste, and my pants fell down. I was into baggy clothes then, but man, not that baggy."
At this, I laughed. I couldn't help myself. He grinned at me, then at the girl, who now had the barest semblance of a smile.
"And another time," he continued, lowering his voice slightly, "I was messing with this tape dispenser, and it exploded in front of my boss and this seriously pretty girl who worked with me. There was smoke, and I had to get down on the floor and clean it all up in front of everyone."
I blinked, remembering. He sure hadn't seemed embarrassed. "And I was pretty now in this retelling?" Just as I thought this, he looked up at me, the tween now tittering beside him, and I felt myself smile. I'd realized a lot of things about Ambrose that day and since, but this one always surprised me. He was kind. So kind. Who knew? Now I watched as he adjusted his tie, then said to us,
"DJ says they'll do the bouquet and garter toss in 15. Next, another half hour of dancing, followed by the grand exit. Then we can start kicking people out."
"Starting with Mrs. Lin," I said as my mother gave me a smile.
"Good luck with that," he replied. "She just read me the riot act about the dessert forks. I don't even know what those are."
My mother, hearing this, turned to look at the nearest table, taking in the place settings there. Even when she thought someone was crazy, she still wanted things to be just right. It was either a professional strength or weakness. I had not yet figured out which.
"Oh, and Luna," Ambrose added as she picked up a fork, conferring with William. "That guy at table 10 asked if I knew where you were. Just a hunch, but I'm betting he doesn't know your strict policy about dancing."
"I don't have a policy about dancing," I told him. "Just dancing at weddings at which I am working."
"Well, you better tell him, because here he comes." Sure enough, when I turned, Ben Reed was approaching from behind me, that same familiar, easygoing smile on his face. My mom and William moved aside, giving me space, and I expected Ambrose to follow suit. But of course, he stayed right where he was.
"Hey,"
Ben said. "You disappeared."
"This is the kind of wedding that keeps you running,"
I explained.
"Having a good time?"
"Yeah." He glanced at Ambrose.
Actually, I wanted to ask you something."
Now, surely Ambrose would leave us alone. He didn't. I turned my body to at least block him out.
"Sure,"
I said. Ben glanced across the country club lawn, where the dance floor, set up under a white tent, was packed with people.
"I wondered if you might want to
Just then, there was a burst of loud laughter from the table behind us, followed by the clinking of glasses. But I'd gotten the idea.
"I can't," I said. "I'm not allowed to when I'm working."
Ben looked confused.
"Like, at all?"
"Well, no." I looked at my mom and William, now discussing the forks. "Because we're part of the staff, it's frowned upon."
"So you can't go out even after it's over?"
Now I was perplexed. Ambrose, however, had not missed anything.
"He asked you if you wanted to do something," he said, leaning into my ear. "I think you misheard."
I felt my face get red, along with a sudden surge of fury that he was even part of this exchange.
"I'm so sorry," I said to Ben, shaking my head.
I thought you asked me to dance."
"Oh," he said. For some reason, he looked at Ambrose. Maybe he thought he might have to interpret this as well. "No, but I can. I mean, I will. I just thought because you were working..."
"That's what I meant," I said, stepping over his words. "I mean, when I said that, clients can't totally forbid me to be social. Yet, anyway." At this, he smiled, and it occurred to me, distantly, that this would be the kind of meet-cute story someone in another situation might tell, years later, part of a beginning.
"Good, because I was beginning to wonder if this was a slave labor sort of situation."
"It can be, but not like that." We both stood there a second, recalibrating. Then I felt Ambrose lean into my ear again.
"You still haven't answered his actual question, FYI.
"Will you butt out?" I said to him through clenched teeth, adding a swat for good measure. This time, he backed away. A bit. With Ben watching like we were both crazy, I took a breath, composing myself.
"I'd love to do something once this is all over, if, you know, you're still asking."
He smiled.
"I am. How about this week? A movie? Dinner?"
"Great," I said. "Just text me. Let me give you my number." As he pulled out his phone, opening up the contacts and handing it to me, I wondered why Ambrose was so interested in this, especially since he had his own perfect, awesome girl and, in his mind, our bet pretty much sealed up. I was going to ask him after I'd typed in my number and Ben walked away. By then, though, he was gone. 2.5 hours later, I was busy untangling yet another tulle bow from a chair. It was 10:30, long past the originally projected end of the Lynn wedding, and we'd just seen the last of the guests out the doors to their cars. This was a full hour after the departure of the bride and groom, which, despite the happy cuddling I'd seen at the head table earlier, did not, as far as my system went anyway, bode well for their union. While the guests threw birdseed and glitter, great for pictures, awful if you didn't want it on you and your clothes for eternity, Eleanor and her groom came out to the limo to make their grand exit. They smiled for the camera and their friends and family. But in the final view I had from my vantage point near the country club gates, she was tugging her bias-cut, fluted dress as if he'd sat on it, her face annoyed, while he sat back against the seat, rolling his eyes. For them, I wished for forgiveness. Maybe, I realized, I believed in wishes after all, at least for other people. Thinking this, I glanced over at Ambrose, who was collecting the large flower arrangements from the tables and toting them to Mrs. Lynn's car. What she planned to do in her hotel room with 20 towering vases of lilies, roses, and greenery was anyone's guess. She'd made it very clear, however, that she would be taking anything the family paid for with her when she finally, blessedly, left. For the time being, however, she was still walking around barking orders. Ambrose and I were the only ones left to hear them, however. My mom and William had taken their ritualistic toast and commentary elsewhere. "End these programs," I heard her saying now, grabbing up the stack I'd brought from the church after the ceremony and put on the cake table. "Are the serving pieces ours?" "No, they belong to the caterer," Ambrose told her from behind a wobbling iris. "Oh," Mrs. Lynn glanced around. "Well, the cocktail napkins, then." She picked them up, then headed my way toward the exit. I made a point of bending down deeply over the chair in front of me, as if untying the bow there was on the level of splitting an atom. "Even so," she said, "I'll want all this fabric from these bows as well. Tulle isn't cheap."
"Will do," Ambrose said cheerfully.
I shot him a look, which he didn't see, too busy trying to keep up with her as she marched across the grass. Not for the first time, I wondered how he managed always to be so good-natured, especially when my own patience had long ago worn thin. By 11:15, all that was left were the tents, tables, and chairs, which the venue would deal with, although I did see Mrs. Lynn, on one of her final passes, studying them as if considering whether they, too, would fit in her rental car. It wasn't until she drove off, the sedan packed to the ceiling, that my mother and William reappeared. They were in a much better mood, red-cheeked and giggly. What Mrs. Lynn gives, champagne takes away.
"Ding dong, the witch is gone," William said as her tail lights turned out of the gates. "That was one for the record books."
"Mark my words," my mother said, "I will not deal with that woman again. If she forgot something, one of you has to get it to her."
"I doubt that's going to happen," Ambrose told her. "She took just about anything not nailed down."
"But the question," William said, pointing at him, "is did you take anything?"
My mom and I looked at each other, not understanding. Then Ambrose, smiling, reached into his pocket, pulling out a handful of tissues.
"Yep."
"Damn!" William cackled. "I owe you $20.
"Am I drunk?" "I don't think I'm drunk," my mom said to me. "But I don't understand."
William was still tittering, pulling out his wallet, while Ambrose carefully folded the tissues. Then suddenly, I got it. "You took those from her bosom?" Hearing me say this, William busted out laughing again. My mom, trying to look stern, said,
"Okay, despite her behavior, that is not appropriate."
"Oh, I think it's very appropriate," William told her, handing over a 20 to Ambrose, who took it with a grin.
"She basically had them there in full view, like a human tissue dispenser. Don't tell me you weren't tempted."
"I was tempted to punch her in the face," my mom said, "but I guess this is the next best thing."
"And the next best," William said, "is us finally being done with this event for good. Next weekend, St. Samara."
"I have not agreed to that, William," my mom said.
"I already called Dr. Kerr, who contacted his travel agent. We leave Friday morning."
"What?"
"Natalie." He put his hands on her shoulders. "When was the last time we got to go anywhere in midsummer
much less a tropical island.
I need this. We need this. We're going. My mom, exasperated, looked at me. I said,
I think it sounds great. You totally should do it.
See, even Luna thinks so. He dropped his hands. Oh, I can't wait. I'm going to buy a straw hat just for the occasion. I'll get you one, too.
I don't want a straw hat.
You'll change your mind, he said easily. Now, come on, let's go finish that bottle at your place. Then we can go online and order resort wear.
My mom still didn't look convinced, but she followed him to the van, climbing into the passenger seat. To be honest, I couldn't remember the last time she'd taken a vacation, and never during wedding season. Everything was different this summer. As they drove off, my phone beeped. It was Ben, already. Interesting.
No, you might still be working, but I was thinking late-night breakfast? World of Waffles?
Well, that's romantic.
Ambrose, who was somehow looking over my shoulder again, said,
Pancakes and thee? That's a seriously awesome first date. You have to do it.
I just looked at him until, slowly, he took a step back.
Why are you so invested in this? You were on us like a chaperone earlier.
I'm a curious person, he said, like this was an excuse. Also, I have a lot invested in winning this bet.
I thought you said you had it in the bag, that Lauren makes it easy.
I do, and she does, but now you're bringing in pancakes. I have to stay vigilant.
I looked back at my phone. It was late evening, the whole night ahead of us. Pancakes would be a great start. And yet I knew I wouldn't. I'd had the most epic of nights once. Things like that didn't happen again.
Wish I could. Wiped. Text me tomorrow?
The little dots appeared. He'd been waiting.
Sure. Sleep good. What? Ambrose said. I looked at him. You just made a face.
Did I?
Yeah.
He read the screen, of course he did, then clicked his tongue.
And I don't get it either.
That is good play he's giving.
Pancakes? Telling you how to sleep? How can you not be into that?
I put my phone back in my pocket. It's not him.
Then what is it?
I looked up at him, trying to figure out how to answer this. In the weeks since we'd gone to Kirby's together, I'd been waiting for the subject of Ethan to come up some other way between us, a passing mention from my mom or William or even Jilly. But it hadn't. As far as he knew, I'd just had a bad breakup. Just too much like a first date I had with someone else, I said. Nobody wants to be a pale imitation. He studied me a second, then he said,
That boyfriend of yours must have really been something. If the split ruined pancakes for you and everything.
Yeah, I said. Plus, I'm tired. But don't worry. Ben and I will have a great date this week. Don't count me out yet. I'm still on track to win. I expected him to laugh at this, or respond in kind with his typical bravado. Instead, he said nothing. Just stood there until I was acutely aware of his silence.
Okay,
he said finally. We'll see. I smiled, shifting my bag to my other arm. It seemed a weird way to leave things, heavy in a sense I couldn't explain. Without thinking, I reached forward to his jacket pocket, pulling out one of those folded Kleenexes.
Sorry, I said. Couldn't resist.
Must be going around, he replied.
A car pulled into the lot then, curving around to stop in front of us. It was Lauren, in a black tank dress and silver bracelets, her hair in loose waves. Ira was in the front seat, panting, his signature bandana, yellow this time, tied jauntily around his neck.
Hey, she said. All done here?
I slipped the tissue into my pocket as Ambrose said,
Yep, let's go.
She waved at me as he climbed into the front seat,
Ira jumping into the back and just as quickly poking his head up through the space between them. Just one big happy family, I thought as they drove off. On my own way home, I passed the world of waffles, lit up and busy as it seemed to be all times of the night, and wondered if I'd made a mistake. Just as quickly, though, I'd passed by, and it was behind me. Chapter 20. By the beginning of the following week, my mom was finally coming around to the idea of a couple of days away. She was predicting the trip would be a disaster, mind you, and saying she'd never agree to an actual wedding that far off-site in a million years. But for her, this was progress. "See that?" she said to me on Tuesday morning, as she sat in front of Daybreak USA with her coffee. Melissa Scott was narrating a segment entitled "Tourist Traps" that detailed various scams crooks used on people while on vacation, or, as it might as well have been called, Exhibit A. "They ask you for help, then they steal your passport, then you can never get home. It's evil genius." "You can get another passport," I pointed out, sticking a straw in the smoothie I'd just made. "You don't have to, like, live there forever." Mom grumbled as Melissa held up the travel wallet the current expert recommended, which basically made it possible to attach your currency and documents to your body in a series of what looked like double knots. "I mean, really. I can't wear something like that. I just shouldn't go. This is ridiculous." I slid into the seat beside her, facing our kitchen TV. "Mom," I said, "what's your real issue here? This can't just be about an off-site wedding. It's too crazy, even for you." She gave me a look. "Oh, that's nice. Thank you." "You know what I mean. Seriously, what gives?" In response, she looked down at her coffee cup, running her finger around the rim. "I've just never been much of the vacation type. That's it." "Because you didn't have the opportunity," I said. "Also, you were stuck with me." "I have never been stuck with you," she replied. Then she reached over, brushing my hair back with her free hand. "You are the best thing that ever happened to me." "Okay," I said, "but you're still not answering my question." Exasperated, she dropped her hand. "Look, I know it's not a popular or common thing, but I like working. I prefer it, actually. If I'm not doing my job, then I feel at loose ends, which is bad enough here at home. But we're going to be on an island with no escape." I raised my eyebrows. "Are you serious? But you always talk about how much you hate your job." "I do not," she replied immediately, clearly dismayed. "No, no. I say that certain aspects get on my nerves and specific brides or circumstances. But the job itself? Never." I sat back, trying to process this. It did actually fit now that I thought about it. "So what you're saying is that all those times I wanted to go to the beach or the mountains or the amusement park, we could have, and you just didn't want to?" She bit her lip. "Well, maybe not every time." I shook my head. "Wow." "I'm sorry," she told me. She squeezed my hand. "Look, there was a point in my life when I was still married to your dad, when I was free to do whatever I wanted. I felt like I should have been so happy, and I wasn't. Then everything fell apart, and I ended up at Linens, etc., as a single parent, and didn't expect to be happy ever again. But when I met William, and we started doing this business, it was like suddenly things just clicked for me. I found my thing, you know? My it. When you come to something like that late, you're always afraid you'll lose it again. It makes everything about it feel precious." "Mom, you were like 22 when you started this business," I pointed out. 22, divorced from a trust fund poet, and I'd spent the last few years raising chickens and making bracelets for a living, she sighed. Finding my calling felt like a blessing, and you don't take blessings for granted. You're allowed a day off, though. Even God took one. And like him, I get my Sundays, she said. That's enough. She got up then, crossing the kitchen to refill her coffee cup. On the TV, Dan Jersey, the news anchor, was somberly reporting on the stock market while a graphic of highs and lows hovered over one shoulder. I studied it, thinking about what she'd said. The calling part I couldn't relate to, not yet anyway, and I loved vacations. But this idea of coming across something so right for you after feeling like you never would, and then being terrified of scaring it away, well, that wasn't so hard to understand. We have 4 weddings left before Bee's, I said to her now as she took her seat again, folding one leg up underneath her. They won't be affected by you relaxing a bit. I'll make sure they're waiting for you the minute you return. Promise. Well, it looks like I don't have a choice, she said, sighing. William already bought us matching hats and caftans. I'm going, like it or not. The way she said this, you still would have thought she was being packed off to work camp in Siberia. But you never know what you can do until you try, and if you're lucky, what you love will always be waiting for you. That's just how it is in most cases. Not all, but most.
The thing is, Julian said, leaning over the table, closer to me, what most people don't realize is that discounting alien life isn't just foolish, it's arrogant.
I picked up my iced tea, taking a sip. In the first 15 minutes at the Thai restaurant, we'd covered the basics, school, family, music, just like every other date I'd gone on so far. Then, suddenly, we were talking extraterrestrials. It hadn't even been a natural segue, either. Julian, the nephew of one of the ladies who owned the stationery store beside our office, just plunged right in.
I'm sorry, I said as our waitress paused by my elbow, refilling the tiny bit I'd already consumed.
It takes a lot of balls to just assume you are the only form of life in the universe, he explained, taking off his baseball cap and smoothing back the dreadlocks beneath it. That's what my talk is about this weekend. The full title is The Hubris of Earthlings, How Narrow-Mindedness Endangers Our Understanding of the Universe.
His aunt, Florence, had mentioned he was in town for a conference at the U. That's what I got for being so worried about the bet that I didn't ask questions. When she said he was my age, a nice guy, and looking for someone to hang out with, I'd just jumped right in.
So you're like an expert, I said now, as he checked his phone, prominently between us and lighting up with messages regularly, on the table. You must be, if you're speaking.
Well, anyone can give a talk if you sign up early enough, he said, typing some response while not looking at me. But yes, I consider myself a scholar when it comes to outer galaxies. We should all be students of the greater world, though. It's our duty. To do otherwise is, frankly...
He looked down at his phone again as a new message came in. Arrogant? I finished for him. He didn't hear me. After the entrees arrived, I excused myself to the restroom, where I took as long as possible washing my hands and reapplying lipstick. If I had to kiss a few frogs to find another prince, I was definitely working my way through the amphibian world. Why was it so hard to find someone I actually liked to talk to? Although really, at this point, I would have taken just some continuous eye contact, or, well, attention. Just as I thought this, my own phone beeped. When I pulled it out, I saw a text from Ambrose. Checking in, he wrote. We'd agreed on this for safety's sake, as it was a date, not at a party or with another couple.
You good?
He likes aliens, I responded.
Who doesn't?
I sighed, ignoring this, then put my phone in my pocket and headed back to the table. I knew the drill now. All I had to do was get through dinner, politely decline dessert, and then offer a firm handshake before heading home. I had to admit, though, that even a week and 3 dates into the bet, I was already kind of over it. But I couldn't quit, after all my big talk, even if August seemed ages, even galaxies, away.
How'd the airport go?
Ambrose asked. I sank into one of the leather chaises of the office, letting out a big breath. Excruciating. But they are on the plane. I went into the terminal and watched the screen until it said, departed, just to be sure.
I'm glad, he said. When she unpacked her entire carry-on, searching for her passport, and it was in her hand, I thought for sure she was going to just bag the whole trip.
Oh, we had like 2 more incidents like that while en route, I told him, rubbing my eyes. I'm starting to think it's a good thing she never goes away. I don't think I could take it.
But she's gone, he said, wrapping a rubber band around the stack of place cards he'd been counting and dropping them into the bin at his feet. And we have the weekend off, just as soon as we finish all this.
I looked at the arrangement of vases, guestbook, cake toppers, napkins, and other nuptial-related items piled on the table in front of me. It had all been purchased for the Margot Wagner wedding, which had been booked for the next day. A moderately expensive, mid-sized double-hander with a shabby chic theme, it was to have been the kind of event my mom and William could do with their eyes closed. And it would have been lovely. I was sure of it. If Margot's fiancé hadn't called it off with a little over a week to go. It was too late to get back any deposits or return stuff, even if she wanted to, which she did not. In fact, the specific orders delivered by her grim-faced mother were that she never hear about this unpleasantness again. We could always use extra supplies for emergencies, but there was still something sad about boxing up all this stuff that had been bought, I knew, with such great plans and hopes. I reached over, picking up the cake topper. It was a groom holding a bride in his arms, both of them grinning. I'll wrap up the candles and candle holders, I said to Ambrose now, getting to my feet. I ripped open a box of tissue paper, pulling out a piece, and picked up a small blue votive. The colors for the wedding were to have been yellow and blue, the bride and groom's favorites, respectively. But to be honest, I never liked the whole green idea. Ambrose glanced over at me.
Green idea?
The tablecloths, I said, nodding at the stack of them on a nearby chair. My mom hates anything but white. But Margot was all about the symbolism, you know, of merging yellow and blue together. So for the reception, she wanted a lot of green. He laughed.
Man, in this business, people can find meaning in everything, even the color wheel.
Weddings make people do weird things, I told him, wrapping another votive. That's the one truth that never changes.
I'm starting to understand that, he replied.
As we worked quietly for a few minutes, I thought of Margot Wagner, a girl fond of heavy makeup and statement necklaces, whom I had met a couple of times at the office. All brides tend to be obsessed with their events, but I remembered her being mostly focused on her huge engagement ring, which she was constantly turning to catch the light. Perhaps, I thought now, it was like a crystal ball, and looking into it, she saw everything turning out perfectly, with yellow and blue and then all that green. Or she just liked the way it shined. Maybe both.
So, Ambrose said now, as I wrapped a larger pillar candle, what's the latest on the dating front? You've been awfully quiet since Alien Lover. Hope you haven't had trouble keeping up your end of the bet.
Nope, I said.
Last night, I doubled with Jilly and Michael Salem with one of his friends, also a food truck kid.
Wow, that's a big community, huh? It's like homeschooling.
It is, I agreed.